اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
سورة الفاتحة. حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل ونعم المولى ونعم النصير. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله. والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله الحكيم في كتابه المتين، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: ألف لام ميم، أحسب الناس أن يتركوا أن يقولوا آمنا وهم لا يفتنون. صلوات.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
The subject that we are on is fitna, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks out in the Quran and says, أحسب الناس أن يتركوا أن يقولوا آمنا وهم لا يفتنون. Where did the people get this idea from, that they can say I believe and get away with it without being tried and tested, without being put into trials and hardships? So we see that one reason that a person, one of the causes of fitna that Allah gives, is iman. And the other one, as is in the words of Rasulullah, the love of Ahlul Bayt. When someone loves Ahlul Bayt, then they also are engrossed in this fitna and in trials and adversities. And there is no way to escape that. And the reason is both iman and the love of Ahlul Bayt are the result of ma'rifat and recognition. Someone who lacks ma'rifat and who lacks recognition cannot have the love of Ahlul Bayt in their heart. Because when someone recognizes truth from falsehood, someone recognizes the attributes of truth, and recognizes the value of the morals that are righteous, then he would recognize and appreciate those who possess them. If someone, he doesn't, or he's not enchanted towards, or for example, he's not liking justice, if he doesn't like justice, then there's no way that he would like the person who is just. You see, if someone doesn't understand what is bravery and courage, he would never appreciate the person who has courage. If someone, he doesn't understand the meaning of fear of Allah and taqwa, he would never understand someone who is muttaqi or never appreciate it. And that's the reason those who understand the value of these morals and the value of these qualities, they are the ones who understand those people who possess them, and that understanding leads them to love. And hence when they love them, it is because of that ma'rifat that they have of what is right and wrong and what is the truth and what is falsehood. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala So other than this, you see that when we are in trials, the first reason that we see, the first reason why a person is in trials or he goes through sufferings in life is one, because of his own sins that we explained. The second reason that I explained yesterday as to why people are in these sins. And I just gave an introduction to that one hadith or one incident of Musa alayhi salam, where he spoke, where he saw this scene unfold before his eyes. And there he saw these three incidents, he couldn't understand it, Allah explained it to him, and then he understood the wisdom behind it. So from that we can understand that the second reason that we go through hardships and sufferings is because Allah intends to give us a greater reward or to save us from a greater hardship that we don't know is coming. And hence, in order to save us from that, He makes us go through hardships now. There is an impending difficulty that is coming that we don't know about. And Allah has the knowledge of that. And hence we see that He makes us go through the trials to stop us from reaching that difficulty which is going to come if this trial doesn't take place. If this trial doesn't take place. You know, for example, you see that you're on a highway and the highway, for example, has a bridge and the bridge is not done. So obviously it's a hazard. And the hazard is to your life. Right? The hazard is to your life. That if you keep on driving, you're going to fall off the bridge. So before that, you see that there are signs put up and they say that you cannot go this way, this road is closed, detour. And you feel agitated that you can't take the highway and you have to take a detour now. Right? Now obviously, this agitation we go through, this hardship that we go through of taking a detour is much better than if that sign wasn't there, and if that detour wasn't there, and we still kept on going. You see? So if we knew what lies ahead, then we would appreciate the detour in front of us. Right? We would appreciate the detour that's there because that is helping us from a greater calamity. And Allah explains this in this incident that we all know about, but I'm just going to go through it to explain the subtle details of how Allah explained this. And this incident also is with Musa. And you know the incident, it is that incident that is between Musa and Prophet Khidr. Now as you know, just to give you a introduction before I speak of the incident, this is obviously one of those incidents that is strange It's not a normal incident. And Allah explained this happening. And because of the fact that it is something strange, Allah, He put this in Surah Al-Kahf. And this is a chapter that is filled with these astonishing incidents. That these incidents that happen that are abnormal, that are not normal, you see that those incidents have been put in Suratul Kahf, or the cave, which is the 18th chapter of the Quran. And this is obviously a strange incident in itself, but then you see that the story of the companions of the cave is also in that chapter. And Allah, He speaks of it. And this ayat also is well known, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أَمْ حَسِبْتَ أَنَّ أَصْحَابُ الْكَهْفِ وَالرَّقِيمِ كَانُوا مِنْ آيَاتِنَا عَجَبًا. Again the word حَسِبْتَ. The same word that is used in these ayat, and with the same meaning. And it says, do you think that the story of the companions of the cave was a stranger sign of Allah? I mean, what made you think that this is a strange sign of Allah, really? And the really, if you want to see the tafsir of what this ayat is, what could be a stranger sign than this? The tafsir of that came after Karbala, when the head of Imam Hussein was reading this ayat. Everyone, when they saw the head of Imam Hussein on the spear, this head was reading this ayat, أَمْ حَسِبْتَ أَنَّ أَصْحَابُ الْكَهْفِ وَرَكِيمُ كَانُوا مِنْ آيَاتِنَا عَجَبًا. Do you think that the story of Ashabi Kahf and the companions of the cave is strange? You see, no, I want you to understand this and see that Allah, He speaks about Ayat-e-Kubra, the greatest sign of Allah. And says that Allah has many signs. And each sign, they direct you to Allah. Meaning, a sign is what? It shows you where Allah is. Meaning, who Allah is. It makes Allah's existence clear to you. It makes Allah evident. And it's an evidence for the existence of Allah. And everything is a sign of Allah. Everything is a sign. We are also signs of Allah. We are ayatullah. You know? So the thing that if you look at the leaves, they're signs of Allah. If you look at any life or non-living things, they're signs of Allah. Because when you look at it, you see that there is a creator behind this. And it is a sign. It is reflecting its creator. It's there. But there are signs that are more clear than other signs. Yeah, there are some signs, you know, that for example have been faded over time or hidden by trees, you can't see them. You know, so we are like those signs. You know, because of the fact that we are faded by the sins and the wrongs that we do, and the ignorance is like the trees that has, you know, stopped other people from looking at this sign and seeing that this sign is actually pointing to Allah. You see? So there are certain signs that are much more clear, and Allah, He calls them the greater signs. And out of those greater signs, there is Ayatul Kubra that Allah speaks about. And when Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, he was asked about what is this great sign of Allah, this greatest sign of Allah. He said, the greatest sign of Allah, Ayat-e Kubra, is Ali ibn Abi Talib.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.
And now when you look at his life and you see, let's see how is he directing us, what in his life is making us think of Allah. Then you see that yes, in his life you see strange things happen. You saw strange things happen, how he single-handedly beat armies. And how he had lifted the door of the or of Khaybar with a single hand. And everyone saw that and they're witness of that, and they're looking at this sign. This is a great sign. I mean, everyone's looking at that and they're thinking that this is strange and this is something unique. This is something unique. No normal human being is able to do that. And they're looking at this sign. But my friends, understand, when Imam Ali became a sign, what was a greater sign? Meaning that they looked at him in the battlefield and they saw courage like no one else. If you look in the history of warfare, you will not find a more courageous and brave warrior than Ali. You will not find anyone who has gone through so many battles and defeated every enemy he opposed. Right, one time or another you see that those who are great warriors, they fall down. But Ali was the only great warrior in history who never fell down. You see, he never fell down. So you see that when you look at the warfare and the battles of Imam Ali, you see that his bravery is becoming so clear. His courage is becoming so distinct from everyone else in the world. But you know what? His courage really did not reach its peak in the battles. His courage did not reach its peak in the battles. My brothers, Imam Ali's courage was not known through the battles that he went through. It was known that his bravery was known when he did not fight, when he saw his wife being oppressed. When his wife was being oppressed and when he kept quiet, this was the sign of his courage. Any man can go in the battlefield and fight. But if someone is accusing your wife of wrong and he's oppressing her, then you see what kind of a man can stay behind for a bigger purpose. This was the sign of his courage. And hence, we look at those things that are clear, but we don't look at those things that are real. The real Ali was known when he stayed in the house for the sake of Allah and Islam. His real courage was known because of that. And this is where we see that when we looked at the story of Ashabi Kahf and the companions of the cave, we saw a strange sign that Allah made them sleep for 300 years. They woke up and it is a strange sign and a wonderful sign. But here Imam Hussein is teaching us that is not the greatest sign. The greatest sign is Hussein standing up in Karbala and giving his life for Allah. This is a stranger sign. This is that sign that is pointing towards Allah. And you see how many lives and how many hearts it has affected to come towards Allah. How many lives and how many enemies are there who are stopping the sign from being known? How many enemies are there who are saying this is nothing? Everyone dies, this is nothing. Everyone dies, you know. Yeah, I've explained these things a lot of time, you know, the thing that we need to understand. My friends, this crying for Imam Hussein and this mourning for Imam Hussein, this itself is a sign from Allah. You know, every year when you are here and you are listening to the tragedies, you don't hear anything new. You don't hear anything new. The others who say, you know, you cry in a movie also. Yeah, you cry in a movie. You know? But you know, in a movie when you cry, it's because of suspense, some thrill, some unknown thing happening at the end, and brings about your emotion and you cry. Now if you watch the movie 3-4 times, it doesn't have the same effect, right? Because the suspense is not there anymore. It's not there anymore. You know what's going to happen. You know what's going to be said. And if you watch that movie 18-20 times, and after that you'll stop watching it. You can't take it anymore. Now when you come over here for Muharram, when you come over here and listen to Imam Hussein, you're not hearing anything new. It's the same old stuff you're hearing every year. You see, the same old stuff you hear every year. But you see, that whenever you hear it, you see that the crying doesn't increase, it keeps on increasing it. The crying keeps on, the mourning keeps on increasing. More people come and take part in it. You see, this, my friends, understand. This is not something that is a result of suspense or a thrill or something. This is the result of Allah who is helping this movement to go, because this is real. This is a real sign from Allah. And hence you see that this is encouraging. That's why it was emphasized by the Imams. How many hadiths are there from all the Imams that said that enhance the mourning of Hussein through any means that you can? They asked us to enhance it through poetry, through reciting it, to informing others, and to listening to it. Why this enhancement? Because of the fact that this is a sign that will bring people towards Allah. And hence you are making that sign clear to the people when the enemies are trying to make that sign ambiguous to the people. And any effort you put in it, then you are working for the cause of Allah. Any effort that you put in it, you're working for the cause of Allah. That's why the Imam had said, even if you write one couplet for the tragedy of Hussein, you see that that couplet will be responsible for you to go to heaven. Maybe that one couplet has changed the lives of many people and invited them towards Allah. You see, this, my friends, this is the reason why it's there. Because it's a sign from Allah. So in this chapter of Ashabi Kahf, and where these strange incidents have been mentioned, Allah now mentions this incident that happened with Musa. And you know this incident, I'm not going to go into the details of this incident. Musa met Khidr, who was another prophet. Now the name, his name is not taken there. In fact, the name of Prophet Khidr is not mentioned anywhere in the Quran. It's not mentioned anywhere in the Quran that he was the one. And now everyone says, how do you know he was the one? Why didn't Allah mention it in the Quran? Well, the reason he didn't mention it is because Quran is not a history book. And that has to mention the name, the date of birth, and all these things of everyone. Right? The book of Allah is a book of guidance. Allah takes out of history what is necessary for the guidance of man. So instead of trying to see what name and what's age and what this is that, see what is the relevance in our life of this incident. We have to see what is the relevance in our life. What can we take from it? So you see, Musa, he was the master of Shariat. He was the alim of the Shariat, of the law of Allah. And Khidr, he was a prophet, but his role is not in the apparent, it is in the ghaib, in the unseen. Allah made the unseen become visible to Musa. What happens in the unseen, he made it become visible to Musa, and Musa saw these incidents that happened. And he wanted to see how, what is the knowledge of that unseen? You see, Allah is what? Allah says, Allah is alim of shahadat wal ghaib. Allah is the alim of what is apparent and what is ghaib. Is he not? He knows what is apparent, what is ghaib. What is apparent, the rules that apply to apparent are shariat, the law of Allah. These are the rules that apply to the apparent. The rules that apply to ghaib are other laws that we describe it as, for example, ilmu takwiniya. Ilmu takwin is that knowledge that applies to the ghaib that we cannot see that Allah is doing behind closed doors. So now, when these two knowledges met, it was described as Majma'ul Bahrain. Majma'ul Bahrain means two oceans. Two oceans, one is the knowledge, the ocean of Shari'at, and the other is the ocean of Taqweem. One was Musa meeting Khidr and Khidr meeting Musa. One had the knowledge of Shari'at, one had the knowledge of Taqweem. And these two met. And when these two met, so now Musa wanted to know the knowledge that Khidr had. Khidr said that, you know what, I can share this knowledge with you, but you cannot be patient with me. He said, you cannot be patient with me. He said, what are you talking about? I am the Prophet of Allah. I am Ulul Adam Prophet. Allah made me an Ulul Adam Prophet for a reason. Because I have patience. If I can be patient with the Jews and Bani Israel, what do you think? I can be patient with them. If I can handle Bani Israel, right? If I can handle them, of course I can handle this. There's nothing, let's go. He said, listen, I'm telling you, you cannot be patient. You cannot be patient. So they went. And now you know the incident. I'm not going to explain the whole incident to you. So what happened is that he went, and Khidr now, he went there, and they reached the village. The villagers, they had a boat, and the boat was what they used for their income. And Khidr got into the boat, and he made a hole in it. He made a hole in it. And he came out. To Musa, this is wrong. Allah's law says this is wrong. You cannot destroy the property of others. That is the law of Allah. You see, that is the law of Allah. And Musa said, this is wrong what you're doing. Haram. This is haram what you're doing. You can't do this. What do you do that for? This belongs to someone else. You're destroying someone else's property. And, you know, for example, if you go outside in the lot outside, right, scratch someone's car, this is haram because it doesn't belong to you. It's someone else's car. Right? Even if you put a scratch, now if you put a hole in it, imagine that. So here you see, he's looking at this, you're a prophet of Allah. How did he choose you? You know, because obviously when you apply for a job, right, you write down your resume, and most people have false resumes, you know. How do you get in this post? And here I'm just trying to explain this to you because both of them are the messengers of Allah. And we respect both of them. But just to make you understand the difference, right? Here you see one prophet. Now, he couldn't understand this. So, again, Khidr said, you see, I told you, you cannot be patient with me. He said, but what you're doing is wrong. He said, no, you cannot be patient with me. I told you that, you know, that's it. No, right, I'll be patient with you. Okay, I'll be patient with you. They go along. And they see this young boy, a beautiful young boy. And obviously, you know, whenever you see a young boy playing and being happy, you also feel happy. You know, because you remember your young age also, when you were playing around. Right? And some people are still playing around even though they're old, right? But those who haven't, at least they look at the young age of these people, and you know, they like it, you know, they like the boy, this and that. And Musa is appreciating the boy playing and this and that. And here goes Khidr, and he takes a knife and kills the boy. Now, if the hole in the boat was bad, now imagine what Musa is thinking about now. Wait a minute, did I meet the right guy? Did I meet the right person? What's this? What's going on here? Right? He didn't. I mean, he was looking at this and he was saying, what's going on here? Look at this. I mean, that, okay, you know, you made a hole in the boat, man, but this, you took someone's life, and that to an innocent boy. You see, you took the life of an innocent boy. What's wrong with this? Because again, the law of Allah says you cannot take anyone's life. In fact, you cannot even harm anyone. You can't just harm people, go and slap someone in the face. It's a crime in Islam to do that. And here he goes without any reason, he just kills the boy. Then they go again. You see, again, now again, you know, that whole thing goes, Khidr says, listen, I told you cannot be patient with me. And Musa says, listen, you know, my patience is running dry right now. What you're doing, you know, I mean, you know, but he says, but I'll go on with you. Now you go forward. He goes forward. And they go forward and they come to this place where these people are unethical, immoral. They are there as a guest, but they humiliate them and disgrace them as guests. And Musa is looking at these people. They have no manners, no ethics. These are immoral people, this and that. Let's go away from here. So, you know, they walk out of that inn, that wherever they were, and there is a wall of that house that was broken down, and Khidr starts to repair that wall. He says, let me at first repair this wall for them, do one good deed. He says, listen, if you had to do a good deed, why don't you do it for the boy? Look at these people. These people don't need good deeds. They need some punishment. They need some whipping. Look at these people, right? We need to do something. I mean, here you have these people who are immoral, who are unethical, and these people who are despicable, and you are helping them build a wall. Helping them repair their house. Let them hire a carpenter to do it. Spend their money. Yeah. You see that? Understand? Again, you know, helping unjust people is also against the Shariat of Allah. Those who are unjust, those who are wrongdoers and unjust, to help them. For example, if someone has a bar, let's say, right? If someone has a bar and you say that, you know what, there's something wrong with the lines over here, could you come and help out? He said, all right, let me come and help you all out with the electric wiring, this and that, I'll do it for you. Right? This is haram. Right? This is haram. Why is it haram? Because you're donating your time for what? To make the bar run.
That's right.
You see, helping the wrongdoers and unjust people is also haram. To enhance their cause is also haram. Right? And Musa is saying, why are you doing this? This is also haram. Not that it's unethical, you know, or this is not akhlaq. He's saying this is haram to do this. These people are unjust people. We have seen that. Why are you helping them do this? You see, understand this. And then after these three tries, after the three incidents that happened, Khidr now made his stance clear. He says, listen, I told you that you will not be able to patient with me. This is a separation between you and me now. Finished. That's it. I cannot handle it anymore. Right? I have work to do. I can't have someone in my ear all the time like this. Right? I have work to do just like you have work to do. Right, if someone comes to you and he does that in your ear, whispers in your ear, shouts in your ear, I mean, you'll be upset also. He said, I can't take this. And the reason is different. The reason he stopped this is because what Musa needed to learn has been taught. In these three incidents, what Musa needed to learn had been taught. And that is a lesson for us. What was that? So now when he made his stance clear, he said, now you cannot come with me anymore. Because he wanted to make these three things clear. Right? He wanted to make three things clear. Here's the three things. Now he explains this. The explanation of that, he said, now listen to me. What I did. And you see this, how it happened. Sometimes, and you see the way he had written it, the way he said it also is different. At first he spoke about the boat. He spoke about the boat. He says, "Ammas safinata, fakanat lil masakin ya'maluna fil bahr." He says, "This boat that I made a hole in. This boat that I made a hole in. This belonged to some labor, some workers, some seamen who used to use this boat, right?" And he says, "فَأَرَدْتُ أَنْ أَعِيبَهَا." I wanted to damage it. I wanted to damage the boat. And why? Because he says that behind them there is a king that is coming. He's going for war, and every boat that is working, he's going to take it by force. You see, these people have a boat that's the means of income for them. And if he takes that boat away, they will never have that means of income. But if I make this hole right now and the king comes by and sees that this boat is not working, he will leave it. They will repair the boat and they will still have it. They'll still have the boat. Right? But if the king takes it, they will not be able to get it back. And their means of income will be lost. See, their means of income will be lost. That's why I made it. I made a hole in there. You know? And you see, each sin is, for example, each thing that you do is graver than the other. Each thing you do is graver than the other. And the prophets are very careful in what they do. And they make sure that they do things according to the will of Allah. My friend, understand the eloquence of the Quran now. This is the first thing he explained. And he said what? I wanted to damage it. I wanted to damage it because I wanted to save their boat, so that they can get it back. Right? This was just a matter of the boat. But when it came to the child, you said, وَأَمَّا الْغُلَامُ فَكَانَ أَبَوَاهُ مُؤْمِنِينَ. This boy that I killed, you know, this boy, his parents are believers. They're good believers, and this is their child. أَخَشِينَ أَنْ يُرْهِكَهُمَا طُغْيَانًا وَكُفْرًا. Now he says that we were afraid. We were afraid that this boy is going to grow up and he's going to oppress his parents. He's going to oppress his parents. And you have seen the hadith I mentioned about oppression of parents. Right? He's going to oppress the parents. So what happened? فَأَرَدْنَا. So we wanted. My friend, understand. And I'll explain the Arabic later to you all. فَأَرَدْنَا رَبُّهُمَا خَيْرًا مِنْهُ زَكَاةً وَأَقْرَبَ رُحْمًا. That we wanted, right? We wanted to change them, to give them a better son than what they have. To give them someone better than what they have. So we took him away and they will get someone who's better than what they have with them right now. Who's going to be compassionate with them and who's going to love them and respect them. Because they're believers. They're believers. We did not want this boy who's going to be a zalim to oppress them because they're mu'min. Now, you see, and then he explains about, for example, the wall. He says this wall belongs to two orphans. And I'll explain that. It belongs to two orphans, and that Allah wanted their wealth because their inheritance was hidden under the wall. Allah wanted to protect their inheritance so that when they grow up, they will be able to get it. They will be able to get that inheritance. You see that? But you see, Allah here is now explaining two things. Right? And three things. In three incidents, he explains three things. The boat was for what, my friends? He's explaining to Musa that, listen, you want to know about the unseen and the laws of the unseen? Listen, there are three reasons. And all these three are afflictions and trials and sufferings. Right? One, for example, you have a car, you got into an accident. Right? You have a car, you got into an accident. For example, it's hardship, it's suffering. Right? So the boat was damaged. Why? Because there was a greater damage that was coming later.
Ya Allah, Ya Allah.
Right? So the boat was damaged now so that it's not taken away from you.
Alhamdulillah.
There was more harm coming. That was the first reason. Allah is explaining the first reason that Allah afflicts sufferings on people is because there is a greater damage that is coming. And to prevent that damage, He makes the smaller damage. That's the first reason. Right? Now with the son, He explains the second reason. That Allah wants to give a believer something better. So He takes something bad from him to give him something good. This is the second reason why Allah puts sufferings on people. See that? Second reason He puts on people. Now the third reason is because they are good people whose property is in danger. To protect their property from other people, He will make that trial come on them that they don't have their wealth right now. Because these were orphan boys. If they had found their inheritance, then others would have taken it from them. So now in order to protect their inheritance, He hid it from the eyes of other people.
Allahu Akbar.
So now you understand why Allah puts us through trials. See, when we see that what's coming, one, to protect us from a greater harm. Two, to give us a greater good. And three, to protect the property of those who are good. This is why He puts us through trials. And He's explaining that. And now, just one more note I will say regarding this ayat so you understand the eloquence of Khidr when he's talking. You know? He says when he damaged the boat, he says, I wanted to damage it. When he killed the boy, he says, Allah wanted to do this. You see, damaging a boat is different than killing someone. He made that note clear that, listen, when it came to killing someone, I don't make that decision. I let Allah make that decision. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala
alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala alihi Muhammad.
See, my friend, understand how eloquent this is. And Khidr is explaining to Musa. Musa wants to know what happens in the unseen. My friends, Allah exposed the unseen for a little bit to Musa. And a prophet like Musa was not able to be patient with it. I told you, a prophet who was patient with Bani Israel, he cannot be patient with it. If Allah exposes the unseen to us, where would we stand? Where would we stand? We would be confused. We would be bewildered. We wouldn't know what to do. This is the reason Allah does not open the unseen for us. These things are happening in the unseen. These accidents you see, these freak accidents you see that happen, these are all planned. Don't think that these are happening by accident. There's nothing that happens by accident. If a leaf falls from the tree, it's not because it's unplanned. It's because there's a plan. There's a plan for that leaf. That's why Allah makes it drop there. You see, there's a plan for that tree. Who knows what the plan is? Maybe the ants underneath are waiting for their risk to come. See, and hence we who are here, when we go through trials in life, when we go through sufferings in life, now obviously we need to understand that if we haven't done those sins, first of all, as I said, whenever you go through a trial, always think that you are the one responsible for it. Meaning you look at those sins that bring about hardship and tribulations. See if we, you know, for example, if I haven't done those things, think really hard. Think really hard throughout your life. Have I done any of these things? Have I disrespected my parents? Have I joked about others? Have I did wrong to others? Think about those things, check them out, and say that, no, I haven't done this, I haven't done this. When you haven't done this, then be satisfied that if you are working for Allah and if your life is being led in the way of Allah, then be satisfied that Allah has something better in store for you than the trials you're facing right now. Really? You see, one of the wives of the Prophet, who truly was the mother of the believers, and she, you know, has done the duties that a mother of the believer does. Right? Her name was Umm Salama. Umm Salama was a veteran of two migrations. There are two migrations in the history of Islam. One was to Ethiopia, the other one was to Medina. Umm Salama was a veteran of two migrations. She went to Ethiopia. As you know, that the first batch of Muslims who migrated went to Ethiopia. And amongst those Muslims who went there, there were some who were misinformed that there was an agreement made with the Prophet and the Kuffar. And there are some of them who came back because they were misinformed on the way. Right? And amongst them was Umm Salama and her husband. They came back. Right? They were misinformed that there was an agreement made with the messenger and the kuffar. And when they came back again, they went through the trials and hardships of being abused by the Makkans. Right? And the kuffar. Until the time came for them to go and make hijrah to Medina. Now they made hijrah to Medina also. Umm Salama and Abu Salama. Both of them made hijrah to Medina. And they went there also. And these were true believers of the Prophet. Both her and her husband. And now you see her husband died in the Battle of Uhud. He died in the Battle of Uhud. She had a son, but her husband died in the Battle of Uhud. He was obviously the provider. He was the provider for her. And then after that, you see that Umm Salama did not have a means of income. Right? Did not have a means of income. And was not able to provide for herself that much. And you know, in Medina, she used to live on the outskirts. Yeah, I won't say the ghetto, because usually the idea of a ghetto is that it's inside the city. Nowadays it happens, because the olden days, the right word that was used was a shanty town. Right? Shanty town was a place where the ex-slaves used to live, you know, on the other side of the railway track. Right? And they used to live there where there's no water, where there's nothing, this and that, and they used to live in that circumstances. And you see, poor people lived there. And so she and her son were living in this place outside of Medina where the poor people lived. In that shanty town. And obviously they will be helped, you know, by the Muslims, this and that. But they didn't have an income for themselves. And the Muslims themselves were also at that time very poor. I mean, the whole state was poor. It wasn't that there was extra money that was giving out to everyone. Whatever there was, everyone was sharing it. There was that, you know, poverty. And here we see that at first the Muslims were poor, then after the Battle of Uhud, it was extremely hard on the Prophet now, because of the fact that now he had to deal with widows and orphans. He had to deal with widows and orphans now. He had to deal with them. What do we do now? Right? So here also you see that it was a very hard time. And she sent a message to the Prophet with her son. And she wrote to the Prophet and said that, Messenger of Allah, I'm not asking you for any material help. I don't want any material help. He said, all I'm asking for you is a dua that I can read in the trials that I'm going through.
Ya Allah.
Give me a dua in the trials that I'm reading through. You know, these hardships that I'm going through. And you know, there we see Rasulullah, he sent his son back with the dua, right, which is called Dua Ni'mul Badal. Dua Ni'mul Badal, it is called. That this dua is to exchange what you have for something better. He sent that dua to her and he told her with the message, with his son, he sent a message that what Allah took from you, right? And he showed a, you know, like, for example, he said something to her son that is a principle that we must understand in life. And he explained that principle to her. And he said that, listen, whenever Allah takes something from you, in exchange, He gives you better than what He took from you.
Yes.
If you are a believer and you are going through trials, if He took something from you, if He took your time, if He took your life, if He took your children, if He took something, He is going to give in exchange something better than what He has taken. With that message, she received this dua. And obviously she was wondering, how can that be? I mean, her husband was there when they made migration to Ethiopia, when they made migration to Adina. He went to the war of Badr, he went to the war of Uhud. He was a mu'min. How can she, with all the trials that she's going through, how can she get a better husband than what she had? You see, but he made that prophecy to her that you're going to get someone better than your old husband.
SubhanAllah!
SubhanAllah!
So now you ask that Umm Salma, tell me, did you get a better husband than the last Prophet of Allah? Understand that this is how it is read, and this dua, that is a very small dua, you read this. He said, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Now obviously Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad is not a part of the dua, right? It is not a part of the dua. It is just the stamp we put on the envelope so that the envelope can go forward. Right? It is the stamp that we put on the envelope. Without the stamp, you know, you cannot even do anything with the dua. Right? So when we read Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, this is like the stamp that you put on the envelope so it can actually go somewhere. Right? Otherwise it's rejected. So what happened is that you say that within every dua. And then you see that it starts off like this. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. He says this verse. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Why? My friend, understand this. Why did Allah say, why is this in the dua? Because when Allah mentioned trials and fitna, when He mentioned trials, He says, وَلَنَبْلُوَنَّكُمْ بَيْشَيِّمْ مِنَ الْخَوْفِ وَالْجُوَ وَنَكْسِمْ مِنَ الْأَمْوَالِ وَالْأَنْفُسِ وَالْسَمَرَاتِ. That we are going to try you with fear and hunger and the loss of wealth and life and fruits. Right? Then inform those who are patient, give them the good news. And who are these patient people? They are the ones who say, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. So in the time of trials, those who say, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un, this is the sign that they are being patient with Allah's trials. Right? This is a sign that they are being patient with Allah's trials. And when they say this, this is how it starts. The dua starts. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Allahumma ja'alni farajan wa makhrajan. Allah, make for me an opening and a relief. Farajan, you know that, for example, we read it every time when we read the ziyarat of our last imam. He says, Allahumma ajjal farajahu. Faraj means the opening, the relief, right? To come out, right? That is what it's called. And hence, Allah, open for me a relief and an opening. Right? Give me a relief and an opening. warzuqni khayran minhu, and provide for me something better than what is there. Right? Provide for me something much better than what is there. And you see this dua, and you can read till the end of the dua, and we gave you this dua so that you can have it. For those who are going through hardships and trials and sufferings, this is the dua, that if you read this dua, then the messenger is saying that Allah is going to give you something better than what He has taken away from you.
Ya Allah.
He's going to give you something much better. Right? And this is, my friends, in the time of trials, this is what has been given to us, so that we can read this and we can understand the trials that we go through and be patient with it. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala ali
Muhammad.
You see, when it comes to orphans, you see, when Allah, He gave that message in that ayat, He said that these two orphan boys that were there, you know how Allah made it clear that what He does with those who are orphans is that Allah protects them. He protects them somewhere or the other. One way or the other, He's going to protect them. And He's going to give that protection to them. You know? And that's why in Islam also it is mentioned that whenever you see an orphan, you should be extra careful in how you deal with it. Extra careful in how you talk to him, how you deal with him. Because you see, understand the difference between an orphan and non-orphan. If some kid is running around and you get angry at him, you'll see that right away he'll go to his father. Right? And he said, you know, that he gets angry at me. Right? But when you do that to an orphan, he cannot run anywhere. You know, he cannot run anywhere. Who's he going to run to? You know, that's why we see that Islam had said that when you see an orphan, you make sure that you are extra careful in how you deal with an orphan. Because when you see someone who's an orphan, you always have to have that extra protection for him, because he doesn't have someone who's protecting him. Allah wanted the believers to be the protectors of orphans.
Yeah.
Right, and have a special place amongst themselves for orphans.
No.
Right? Because of the fact that Allah wants them to grow up knowing that they are mu'min and that the believers are their guardians. Right? Believers are their guardians. Now, obviously, this is the teaching of Islam. It's the teaching of Islam. Right? And we know this. And our hearts are moved by this. Imagine when we see an orphan, how careful we are. And how much more compassion we have and mercy we have towards an orphan. If this is our situation, then imagine how the Ahlul Bayt, they deal with orphans. How much more compassion that they have for orphans. How much more love they have for orphans. And this is the reason the most beloved amongst Ahlul Bayt was the son of Imam Hasan Qasim. Qasim was the most beloved amongst Ahlul Bayt. He was the one that everyone had extra care for and love for, especially Imam Hussein. Because he understood that not only is he an orphan, but he is the orphan of his brother. That Imam Hussein loved very much. Imam Hussein, he loved Imam Hassan a lot. Imam Hassan was like his hero. Imam Hassan was like his role model. And Imam Hussein, in his whole life, his love for Imam Hassan was such that he would never At the time Imam Hassan was alive, he would never walk ahead of him, he would always be behind him. He would always be there to be his support and his back. This was Imam Hussein, who loved Imam Hassan. So when Imam Hassan died, it was hard for Imam Hussein. He cried the most when Imam Hassan died. So now, when Imam Hassan left an orphan, that is Qasim, now Qasim became the beloved of Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein would be there every day to meet Qasim and to be with him, and to play the role of the father that he never had in the sense of growing up. You know, Imam Hussein, this was that immense love that he had for him. And you know that he would never let Qasim feel like he's an orphan. Would never let him be in a situation that he feels helpless. Any place that he needed help, you see, he would go and listen to Qasim with such speed. It was like Imam Hussein was the servant of Qasim. Growing up, that was the case. Whenever Qasim wanted something, Imam Hussein would jump to it, so that Qasim would never feel that there's someone not giving me something. This was that relationship that this uncle had with his nephew. This was that relationship that he had with his nephew. That is why you see that when the night of Ashura came, and the mother of Qasim, Umm Farwa, on the other hand, she knew how Imam Hussein loved Qasim. But on the other hand, Umm Farwa was in a very precarious situation. Because everyone who was there in Karbala, they had a wali who was with them. They had someone who was there with them, who was related to them, and they had someone there. Umm Farwa was the daughter-in-law of this family. And Imam Hassan had been martyred 10 years before. Now you see Umm Farwa, the mother of Qasim, she on the night of Ashura, she told Qasim that Qasim, you know, tomorrow Qasim, that Ali Akbar and Onan Muhammad are going to go in the battlefield. They're getting ready. Qasim, you know, you are the son of Hassan ibn Ali. Your father was a martyr. He gave his life in Allah's way. My son, you know, she had in her mind how many accusations Imam Hassan had faced. And Imam Hassan had never had the chance to show who what his courage and bravery was in the battlefield. When you see that Umm Farwa, she wanted Qasim now to go forward, and Qasim, and she told him that, listen, make your father proud of you. Do not back down from the battlefield. Make sure that you will be one of those who will get martyred. I cannot have it that you will live and Ali Akbar is dead. I will not be able to tolerate it. How can I show my mother-in-law my face on the day of judgment? I will go and meet Fatima on the day of judgment. How can I show that? So you see, she told Qasim that go and ask your uncle, will your name be there in the list of the martyrs? So Qasim went to the meeting that the companions were having, and he knew that Imam Hussein was having with the companions. Qasim was also there. Qasim is 13 years old. But you see, this is the training of Ahlul Bayt. Their marifat is marifat. Their iman and their level of fear of Allah is at a different level than what we face. These are children who have been raised in infallibility by masoom who are infallibles. And you see that the 13-year-old child is there amongst men, and he sits there, and then you see Imam Hussein, he turned towards Qasim and said, Qasim, why are you here? Go back to your mother, Qasim. Qasim said, Asim said that, "Uncle, I came to ask you, is my name also on the list of martyrs tomorrow? Is my name on the list of martyrs tomorrow?" Then Imam Hussain asked him a question, "Qasim, tell me, what do you think about death? What do you feel about death?" Imam Hussain, "Who are you asking? A 13-year-old boy? A 13-year-old boy you're asking, who's an orphan, you're asking him about death?" He asked Qasim about death, but as I said, these are those who have been trained by Masumin. Qasim said, "Death to me is sweeter than honey. Death to me is sweeter than honey. Oh, how much I wait for it. How much I wait for it." So Imam, he said, "Just tell me, will my name be there in the list of martyrs?" How can Hussein reply to this? Hussein looked at Qasim and said, "Qasim, you're asking about yourself. Ali Asghar's name is also on the list of martyrs. Ali Asghar's name is also on the list of martyrs." Qasim said, what, these people are going to come in the tents and they're going to take lives in the tents?" He said, "How can Imam Hussain explain to Qasim that, no, I will take Ali Asghar out to ask for water and they will kill Ali Asghar in my hands?" Qasim is afraid that the people, that this army is going to come in the tents. He could not tolerate that fact. Qasim, how can we tell you what happened after Ashura? How these people came in the tents and they took the hijab of your mother. Qasim now, when he stood up, Imam Hussain hugged him. And then Qasim went away. Now the day of Ashura came, and I'm going through this. And may Allah give you the blessing that you receive from this tear. And may Allah make the dua of Fatima reach you. You see, on the day of Ashura, when it started, everyone of the martyrs, they did not want any of the children of Hussein to go before them. So they all gave their lives before the children of Hussein. One by one, they went forward to give the lives, and they gave their lives. And now you see that before that time came, when that time came for the children to go, Ali Akbar went first. Imam Hussain wanted Ali Akbar to go first, and he went. And then you see, after Ali Akbar came back, now the tents were not the same. Everything was different in the tent. Now each mother was looking at her son and saying, "Why are you still alive? Why are you still alive? Hussain's children are dying and you're still alive." And Qasim, every time someone would come back as a martyr, he would go forward. He would go forward to his uncle and say, "Uncle, please give me the permission to go in the battlefield. Allow me to go in the battlefield." Hussain would look at Qasim and said, Qasim, "I cannot let you go. You are the memory of my brother Hassan. I can't let you go. You are the memory of my brother Hassan. Go back to your mother." And Qasim would come back to his mother, and the mother would get angry at Qasim and said, "Why are you still here? Go to the battlefield. Give your life for Allah." Qasim would be stuck in the middle, and then he was sitting outside the tent of his mother, and he was crying. My mother asked Qasim, "Why are you outside here? Why are you crying?" He said, "What can I do, mother? I come to you, you get angry. I go to my uncle, he doesn't allow me. I am stuck between two things. I cannot do this, I cannot do that. My uncle is not allowing me." Then his mother, "My friend, this is how Allah protects an orphan, and He makes the way for an orphan. Allah protected this beautiful child for the day of Ashura." And he said, and then his mother remembered, and then my mother remembered, "I remember that when my husband had died, he gave a locket for you, Qasim, that you have in your hand. that is tied on your hands, Qasim. That locket that is tied on your hands. My husband had given to me. Imam Hassan had given to me. And he said that when Qasim is in deep trouble and trials, open this locket and you will find a relief for him. Qasim was in a trial from Allah. 13 years old. But Allah is trying him in such a way that you see what a trial he's facing. I want you to understand that. What a trial is he facing? You see, Ismail, when he went to be sacrificed, his eyes were closed so that he could be sacrificed. But Qasim's eyes are open and he's looking for his death and searching for his death. This is the ma'rifat of Qasim. Now Qasim, now he opens that letter and he sees the letter. The letter is from Imam Hassan to Imam Hussein. And Imam Hassan wrote to Imam Hussein saying, my brother, when you will read this letter, you will be in deep trials and you will be on your appointed day. Now, I will not be there to help you. I will not be there to be with you. But I'm giving my offering that is Qasim. I'm giving my offering that is Qasim. Take this Qasim and allow him to go in the battlefield. When Hussein read the letter, he saw the writing of his brother and his tears are flowing from his eyes. He looked at Qasim and remembered his brother Hassan. He said, Qasim, come to me. And both of them hugged. And it is said that they cried for such a long while that they were falling down, crying, hugging each other. And said, go Qasim, go and bid farewell to your mother. And when he went inside and bid farewell to the mother said, Qasim, I will send you to the battlefield, but not like this, Qasim. Come here. Then she took out the dress, the wedding dress of Imam Hassan. And she put that dress on Qasim. She put that dress on Qasim, the Imama of Imam Hassan. You see, Ahlul Bayt, when they made offerings to Allah on the day of Ashura, they packaged their offerings to let them know why they are giving these offerings. This is for Allah's pleasure. Qasim, he wore the dress of Imam Hassan on the day of his wedding. When he came out of the tent, then everyone who was left in the tent and everyone who was left around the tent, Imam Hussein and Abbas, they couldn't help but cry. They looked at Qasim, this beautiful child that is there. And now you see that he is there and he is going towards the battlefield. Imam Hussein and Abbas helped Qasim to get on the horse. And Qasim now goes to the battlefield. I'm finishing, my brothers and sisters. Just these last few sentences, and you see that orphan, that offering that Imam Hassan had given, is now going out to the battlefield on Ashura. Qasim goes forward, fights a fierce fight, shows the courage of Ali, he shows the courage of the Imams. And now that time came when someone came from the back and hit Qasim on the head, and that hit on the head that made Qasim fly off his horse, and he went to the ground. And he said, Ya Ami, my uncle, accept my last salah. Oh Hussein, who used to run at the bidding of Qasim, who used to go and do everything Qasim asked him. Hussein, they said, ran. He flew like an eagle to the battlefield. Abbas went there. The army saw Hussein coming with such speed that they started running backward. When the horses went backward, they trampled the body of Qasim. When Imam Hussein reached Qasim, his right ribs were on the left side. His left ribs were on the right side. Qasim was taking his last breath. Imam Hussein fell down at
at the feet of Qasim. He said, my nephew, it is hard on your uncle that you called them and your uncle could not help you. Qasim, in the last breath that we had, was saying, my father Hassan. You see, Qasim wasn't confused between Imam Hussein and Hassan. He saw the doors opening and he saw that his father had come to greet him and take him to the abode of
Yao Zhang.